I'm Greg Hunter. Welcome to USAWatchdog.com. Well, this is a return visit by one of the guys who had his fingers on the pulse of this COVID thing early on and was telling people they should be taking hydroxychloroquine and zinc and a Z-Pak. And, you know, of course, that all got poo-pooed, and now it's real science. Also, he's also an expert on, you know, these what's coming up and how many problems we have. It's not just COVID. We have all kinds of financial problems. We have all kinds of, earth change problems. We have all kinds of political problems. There's a lot to navigate. And that's why for a return visit, back on is Chris Martinson, Dr. Chris Martinson of peakprosperity.com. Dr. Chris Martinson, thanks for joining us today on USAWatchdog.com.
Thanks, Greg. It's good to be back with you and all your listeners today.
I know you have a two-day seminar coming up the 24th and 25th of October. That's it. 24th, 25th of October is a video seminar. It's a couple of days. It's a lot of information. We're going to try to touch on some of that today, but you know, we're not going to have, you know, but 45 minutes or so, whatever. We'll talk about that at the end, about all the stuff that you have coming. 2 days conference is a lot. But let's start with the CDC. And are you surprised with the CDC publishing new rates for COVID? Of course, the mainstream media that, lied and obscured actual real scientific information all the way around. I'll hold it up here. You can see the survivability rates, the 0 to 19 age, it's 99.997% survivability. And if you look down here, it's 20 to 49, 99.98, 50 to 69, 99.5, 70 plus 94.6. I mean, talk about having overreaction egg on your face. I mean, what's your read on this?
Well, if you graph that out, and I've done this recently, I have these online videos that I produce around COVID and things like that for people who care about data and political free facts and things like that. If you graph it out, you find out that the mortality for COVID increases exponentially with age. So, and it's a perfect straight line on this chart, and it means that somebody who's 80 plus years old has 3.5 orders of magnitude more of a chance of dying than somebody who's 0 to 10 years old, right? It's an astonishing thing to see. So that's the first thing. And what we make of that is that if you want to protect your society, and the CDC is nominally about protecting society and is supposed to be about health and keeping us all healthy within bounds, right? You would say, well, this isn't that hard of a thing to solve. We keep our most at-risk people safe as we possibly can. Everybody else can get on with their lives. This is a story I've been running with for a while now, and that's on my most recent video, talking about how Australia, the UK, a lot of Europe and the United States are all going a little overboard on this whole thing and being ignorant and unsophisticated about it. Because if you're unsophisticated, you say, we have to lock the whole country down, everybody. If you're sophisticated, you say, no, we don't. Obviously, people who are a little bit older, people with comorbidities, let's keep them safe. Everybody else can get on with their business. But as you opened with as well, the real tragedy in the story is that this is even less. Those numbers you have, we can make those numbers even smaller if we give people appropriate treatments, which includes things like vitamin D, which Anthony Fauci has recently admitted he's taking. Huh. First time I heard him even mention it, right? So there's a lot of things we can do for people to keep them healthy. And we're not doing them, and we're just doing these lockdowns, which are also extremely unhealthy for people.
What the governor did, and I know you don't want to be political, but he had a hospital ship, he had the Javits Center, he had a hospital made for him, and he sent people to nursing homes who had COVID. I mean, judging by what you're talking about, older people were exponentially more at risk, and thousands of people died. He's holding the real numbers back, but it's, some people say it's 3, 4, 5 times higher than 5 or 6,000. It's 25 or 30,000 people died. I mean, that's where the tragedy lies, right?
It is. And there's a lot of tragedy around the deaths, and deaths is kind of how we sort of benchmark most of these illnesses. But the truth is, COVID-19, the disease, is also not really pleasant for people who even have what we call mild cases. We're finding out there's a lot of heart damage and other things like that. But again, these are mainly for people. I'm going to bet you anything that when we sort of parse through the data, we find out that these were people who just were lacking in some basic nutritional support that they would need to have in their body, including things like vitamin D or who knows what else. But we're not really interested in that data. You know, everything that the U.S. government is doing, from the CDC to the FDA to the NIH, all they're doing is basically saying, hunker down, wait in your basement, we got a vaccine coming. That's great if we get a vaccine someday, I guess. But you know what we could be doing in the meantime and should be doing is understanding that even if you give somebody a vaccine, it's still their own body that recognizes the antigen and mounts a response to that. And they're setting the threshold at the vaccine. Does it provide 50% benefit, right? Well, you know why your body mounts a defense is because it's healthy. How is it healthy? Well, it needs to have vitamin D for starters, for sure. But maybe some other things could be very supportive in there as well. And now we're also, Greg, seeing lots of data coming from not Western countries where they're experimenting with things and trying things like ivermectin, like hydroxychloroquine, like the artemisinin products, and achieving great results with these things. So if we lived, you and I, in an actual legitimate culture, we would have our official bodies out there saying, what works, what doesn't work, what do we know, let's do some trials. Here's how bad it is. Ivermectin, it's an antiparasite. It seems to work really well. Fantastic early results. Doctors in the US have said, wow, look at these amazing results. We'd like to have some studies so that we can actually really go forward with this. Nobody's doing any studies like this. So a doctor has actually ponied up $250,000 of her own money to run a trial on something that already has tremendous clinical results coming out of other countries. How disturbing is that, that you live in a country where something that might work and might work really effectively is being ignored, and billions are being thrown at vaccines which may or may not work, and we're all hopeful, but who knows, right? It's really troubling at this point.
Donald Trump came out early on and said, hey, this could be a game changer. And that was hydroxychloroquine, zinc, Z-Pak. Mm-hmm. And there's clinical results. Didier Roux over in France is one of the top, infectious disease doctors. Zev Zelenko over here had big results, lots of studies. There's all kinds of science surrounding it. You brought it up here early on. It got poo-pooed in the press. It got poo-pooed at the FDA. It got poo-pooed politicized. Is there blood on these people's hands? I mean, all these doctors, these frontline doctors came out, and one of the things that sticks with me is nobody needed to die.
And a lot of people could have been saved. So we can decide where blame falls in that particular story. But I know of doctors that were running trials where even they decided to investigate hydroxychloroquine, where they designed the trials to fail. And so you decide how you want to morally describe a medical professional who plays with people's lives in order to make a point and prove that something doesn't work by using it wrongly. In the UK,
this is hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and
hydroxychloroquine, right? So everybody who's used it's a combo therapy, right? You've mentioned it, right? Azithromycin, hydroxychloroquine, plus zinc. And it seems to be, for whatever reason, those three things work. So we have a bunch of trials where all they tried was hydroxychloroquine, or they tried it late. We know it's an antiviral. When do you want to stop a virus? Early in its replication cycle. After it's gone through its replication cycle and your body is now fighting itself with a overblown immune response, hydroxychloroquine predictably would do nothing in that scenario. In fact, it does predictably nothing. And in one really tragic case in the UK, they took people who were not only past the replication cycle, not only really sick, so they're infirm, but they gave them toxic doses of hydroxychloroquine and then said, look, this stuff actually makes people sicker, not better. It's hard to describe just how evil that really is. I'm shocked by what I've been seeing.
I am stunned that they politicized this the way they did. I mean, they could have saved many people. The results were there. And now we know the science is there to back up everything you had said early on. That, you know, hey, you should be taking and what the president said. They made him out to be a stooge, a boob, an idiot. And Fauci was pushing remdesivir, which had very not great results. And said, oh, no, that's not that. Fauci. I mean, thousands of people died because of these people.
Yes, and it didn't have to be this way. We had the data early on. So all I did was, I do have a medical background. My degree's in pathology. I know how to interpret studies, and I have, you know, basic common sense. So all I was doing early on, Greg, was I was just reading reports, reading papers. And this is a fast moving, brand new disease. Turns out it wasn't all that brand new. We shouldn't be calling it a novel coronavirus, because it turns out that if you've had exposure to prior cold, common cold viruses, coronaviruses, that you have either some or even full immunity against this coronavirus too. Some people seem to have gotten the luck of the draw on that. So we have experience with coronaviruses, and not only that, but we had experience with SARS. Not only that, but we knew that hydroxychloroquine was used effectively in vitro, in glass experiments, right, against SARS back when. And we even have that data coming to us through the NIH itself. So you have this body that has all the data, excuse me, and knows that this stuff works, and yet does everything it can to sort of push that under and elevate remdesivir, which, as you mentioned, it was worth trying. I was totally for getting that in trials. Let's see what happens. Put it in the trials, and guess what? It didn't really work all that well, but they gave it every possible opportunity that they didn't give to hydroxychloroquine. They gave it early, and they even changed the endpoints mid-trial to find a favorable one in there, because it turned out it didn't change mortality, but people seemed to spend a few less days in the hospital. So that's all they could really point to, was people spent less time in the hospital on it. Whereas when you say with Didier Raoult and other doctors out there with their observational studies were saying, look, ethically, I can't not give something I know that's going to help save somebody to them. So I'm going to give everybody this stuff. And I'm going to tell you, wow, Didier Raoult had a 0.5% overall death rate across thousands and thousands of patients.
The downside was nil.
Nil. It's a very safe compound. It's been safe for 70 years, and all of a sudden it was super dangerous. Or, oh gosh, you know, if we start giving it to everybody, the people who really need it, who have lupus and things like that, won't be able to get it. But of course, it's so easy to make that Costa Rica said, well, why don't we just start making it ourselves? And they did that like within a month. Like it's really not a difficult compound to make. And so all the stories we heard that it was dangerous, that it didn't work, that we were going to run out of it, none of those were true.
They lied. People died.
Yep. And I can't explain why. I don't understand it.
Should we open back up now? I mean, in your estimation, should we really work at opening up most everything?
Oh, absolutely. And we can do this, but we'd have to be smart about it, right? None of this is controversial to me. Step one, you help people prepare their terrain of their body, right? If the government's going to do anything, send everybody vitamin T and tell them how to take it, right? It's a pill. It's very easy.
And Fauci's on board with this.
He should be, but he hasn't. He said he's taking it personally, but he wouldn't recommend it necessarily for other people because, why would you do that? I guess, I don't know. I can't explain it. So that's step one. Step two, if you do have people who are out and about, particularly people who are vulnerable or interfacing with vulnerable populations, you wear masks. If people in those situations wear masks, what happens is it prevents, if I'm sick and transmissive, it prevents me from putting out more of this stuff out of my mouth. Or if I'm healthy, it prevents bigger amounts from coming in. It's called lower the inoculum. If you lower that enough, when people's bodies are exposed to a very low inoculum, they have a much better chance of fighting it off with minimal impacts. That's pretty well established. Three, though, if somebody does get exposed or you're worried about it or they test positive and they've all of that, you just prophylactically, boom, you put them on the triple combo therapy, right? It's either hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin plus zinc plus an antibiotic. If you just do that, I think we're most of the way there.
And you would open up, now. You know, this idea where I can't open up to schools when there's, I know, 99.997 problems with children. You would open up now.
Here's the thing. There's no getting rid of this at this point. It's endemic. It's with us. It's here. So we are going to have to learn how to live with it one way or the other. So because of that, yes, you might as well start living with it. But just be smart about it. It's not that hard. This is common sense, right? So, all those three things I just mentioned, what would I do next? Well, if somebody does come down with symptoms anyway, we don't know why, their terrain was prepared, we gave the ivermectin and or hydroxychloroquine, whatever, they still get sick. Well, now we know how to treat this thing much better using things like the MATH Plus protocol, again, developed by doctors out of Virginia in this case. where you give people methylprednisone, a steroid, a heparin to prevent the clotting from happening. It works really, really well. So we have very good treatments that we have now that are available without necessarily people having to go fully into the hospital. And if they do go into the hospital, you give them the best support. We understand other things. So we can be really clever about this now. What's not clever is saying we just have to shut everything down. Come on, we're 9 months into this. This shouldn't be this hard at this point in time to develop a common sense approach that really makes sense. And I don't think you just say, oh, forget about it, we just open everything like that either, right? You gotta be smart about this, because this thing, I really would not want to come down with a bad case of coronavirus. I would not want that. And I wouldn't want anybody to do that. But we know a lot that we're not doing at this point. And if I was going to solve this all in a single snap, I would take half the NIH's budget and say, you really screwed the pooch on this one. Sorry about that. And take that same budget and I would put it over into a new entity. And their job, they could only investigate off-patent medicines and various therapies. And they wouldn't be afraid to try things in combination, because that's science is like, oh, if you don't give hydroxychloroquine all by itself, we can't say that was the causative thing, right? So this body would then just go out and find stuff that worked, wherever it worked, and then drug companies would have to beat those results, not placebo, right? You say, oh, we have a vaccine, it's we think it's going to be amazing. I want to see if you can beat azithromycin plus zinc plus either.
That's going to be tough to beat.
If you can beat that, you might have something that's worth talking about. If you can't beat that, back to the drawing board. That would be a sane response to all of this, is use what works, what is the most cost effective, not the newest, most expensive thing that provides a lot of money that then funnels back in through political action campaigns and keeps the whole thing going. Not that.
Things you never hear on mainstream television, Chris Martinson. You've been on a few times, but okay. So now we're through the hump. It's not as bad as they said it was. We have all kinds of treatments. Got check, check, check. Okay, so yeah, it was serious, but the overreaction. But overreaction, let's talk about the damage to the economy. We just had 870,000 people apply for first-time unemployment benefits. We're up to, in some cases, they're saying that the total ball of wax is 38% of the workforce. And, you know, how many people have filed is 62 million people. So lots of damage done to the economy. What do you see right now? Lay out your biggest fear of what's going on with the economy and society right now. What's your peak prosperity overview of how bad this is? We've screwed the pooch on this, to your point.
It's very bad at this point in time, and it's being covered up by a very, very complicit Federal Reserve that's just propping markets up. And I don't know if you saw in Bloomberg, it just came out today, that Citadel, where Ben Bernanke works, a former Fed chair, is just crushing it this year. Their first half of the year, they made more money than any other year alive. This company does nothing. They just front run the Fed and scoop billions. They're skimmers, right? So the Fed's really rewarding giant companies and skimmers and grifters, and that fits. That's sort of their mission philosophy and motto, I guess. Meanwhile, Yelp just reported that nearly 100,000 U.S. businesses have permanently closed. These would be coffee shops, restaurants, little inns, hotels, you know, parks, all kinds of things. They're just crushed in this story. And, you know, the Federal Reserve likes to pretend like, oh, you know, fiscal side needs to do something. That's not our job. But they've been very, very preferentially shoveling money to the super elites in this story while everybody else has really been suffering. And so they do own quite a bit of this story. And then as well on the fiscal side, you know, it's just been astonishing, Greg, watching the $1,200 stimulus check was supposed to do what exactly? You know, it's September. You know, how are people supposed to be, you know, making it by on that? So the stimulus that has gone out has mainly gone to the well-connected, the mega corporations, the big banks and all of that. And it's really just cut the legs out from what I'll call upper middle class on down is the way I look at it at this point. So that damage has been done. And the extent to which we're seeing more calls for lockdowns and things like that, which is happening all across Europe right now and in Australia, I think those are going to just complete the process. So I'm very.
What's the process? What will happen at the end of it? What are they shooting for? Or what do you see happening? Is it going to get better or is it going to get worse? And how worse?
Well, the only way out of something like this is to create a lot of people who are dependent on the state, right? So to the extent that Millions and millions of people have lost their jobs, right? And you just mentioned, you know, the statistic that in the United States, 870,000 people filed for unemployment claims. Let me temper that number. They're not everybody's eligible to file for unemployment claims. And the number of people who are eligible is shrinking all the time because they've already applied, they've already exhausted their benefits, somehow it didn't work out for them, or, you know, they were self-employed. So for the people who were self-employed, small business owners, absolutely just getting crushed by this whole thing. And so when I say complete the process that I see undergoing is, I guess I have to say it looks like it's going somewhere, is small and medium-sized enterprises are being sacrificed here. And nobody's interested in helping them, nobody in D.C. that I can tell, nobody at the Federal Reserve. And when this process is over, all of those people are going to be somehow dependent on the state. And I don't know if that was the plan, but that's where we're going.
I had a letter from a guy, I'll bring this up, I should have brought up my weekly news wrap up, but it was a guy, and this is points to what you're talking about. Here's a little the micro level, getting down to the gritty levels. A guy named George, he has contacted me before. He had a little store that got creamed. And then he has a private bar. The governor has opened up other bars, but he hasn't opened up private bars. There's 1,000 of them in the state of North Carolina. So he's getting creamed on both ends. He's just like, the businesses I had started, ran, I can't run either one of them, according to the edict of a guy with a free button on his desk, the governor, Baby Killer Cooper, who gets a government paycheck. The people making the decisions are people who get government taxpayer paychecks. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, isn't this political? Isn't this really totally political?
Well, it is a question of politics, but it's really sort of a accelerating a process that's been going on for a long time, which is our culture has been very specifically picking winners and losers, right? So again, back to the Fed, they decided savers should be losers, borrowers should be winners in this story. Getting 0% on the money you save, that's being penalized because obviously inflation's a lot higher than zero. So they're penalizing those people, but for who? Well, for borrowers. So they'd really rather have people reward those people. As well, the Federal Reserve has said, well, we're going to inflate asset prices because, you know, that feels like the right thing for us to do. But of course, that rewards all the people who own assets. So try and act surprised in this story when it turns out that, say, BlackRock, another super well-connected company that's helping the Federal Reserve distribute its money. You know, you're going to read stories about BlackRock buying up tens of thousands of homes, mobile home parks, water systems, electrical, whatever. It's this. Honestly, Greg, if I had to say what we're experiencing in the United States, it's kind of like what third world countries have gone through for a long time. You get these predatory outfits come in and they end up, surprise, owning all of your actual cash producing productive assets. When this is all said and done, they own your homes. They own your utilities. They own your ports and railroads and roads. I don't know. Is that going overboard to look at it that way? Well, it's what's happening.
And for people out there who don't really understand you, you know, they probably just see you. You've got probably a lot of people that just know you as Dr. Crit Bartz, and he knows all about COVID. In your infectious disease PhD, is that? I always get this wrong. Is that right?
Pathology.
Well, okay. Oh, close. PhD. Earned PhD. But you've been doing the crash course on peak prosperity. I mean, I got introduced to you with the financial end. You know, you're this medical expert, you know, that you very wonderful credentials, and you handle the COVID thing fabulous. But there's a lot of people who know you for the financial end. And so that's why I want people to know, wow, how can this guy talk about the economy? You've been doing it for more than a decade. I tell people, get the crash course. You put that out free on your website, the crash course. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. Let's talk about gold. Gold's had a nice run. It's been, you know, beat back a little bit, but the Fed balance sheet has doubled. That's what they're willing to tell us. It went from 3.7 to 7 something trillion dollars, 3.7 trillion to 7 something trillion. I mean, their money printing is unbelievable. They got a hold up in Congress now with Pelosi, who wants 2.2 trillion. The Republicans are fiscally conservative, only want 1.5 trillion in new Corona cash. What's going on with the dollar and the gold relationship in your estimation?
Well, the price of gold that's quoted out there is the one that's subject to all these manipulations. And by the way, I believe JP Morgan just got dinged for having manipulated these markets again. So what we found particularly with this whole FinCEN scandal that just happened, is we've discovered that anytime you peer at what the banks are doing, they're up to their usual tricks of manipulating things and being corrupt and funneling drug money around the world and doing all that stuff, right? Anything for a buck. Well, the price of gold that people are familiar with is the one that's quoted because of the paper contracts that trade. I don't follow that as nearly as closely as I used to. What I am tracking is the amount of gold that's available out there in the world for people to get their hands on. And, you know, it's there's a huge story there developing for all sorts of hard assets. Gold is a good one because it's a monetary asset. But there's a story there around silver. There's a story there for rhodium. There's a story there for water. There's a story there for land, raw productive land, things like that. So that's really the track I've been on. Look, when history's pretty clear on this, when humans inevitably default to coin clipping, paper currency printing, or clacking an electronic keyboard to create trillions out of thin air, what happens next is they find it difficult to stop that process. They keep doing it. More and more people begin clamoring for a share of all that free money. We're seeing that show up in this election cycle. And then eventually that just, you know, wears itself out and it breaks. So this is why I'm such a critic of the Federal Reserve. Not only are they stoking social tensions by unjustly rewarding and making wealthy, already wealthy people, which is not good. It's corrosive to do that. But they're leading us down a path that really has a binary outcome. And it's heavily weighted towards one of those two outcomes, and that's destruction of the currency system involved. So when you ask where I am on the dollar, it's a complicated, convoluted answer, but it's ultimately we're printing way too many of them under the idea that somehow magically the economy recovers. And the way I'm looking at it, the actual legs of the stool that support the economy, which is small and medium-sized enterprises, has been just absolutely cut at the knees, just taken out. So we're printing more and we're going to be producing less. Greg, how does that story end?
You, I think it ends awful. It's a good way to wrap it all up. This is all the stuff is going to be covered in your conference as well. So I'm sure this and much, much more. It's going to be 2 days. It's going to be hours and hours. So we're really just kind of glancing over the surface, and I'm not trying to sell your conference because I don't get paid for this. I just like you and like promoting what you do. So you'll have to buy the conference, so I can't get to everything. There's a lot there. So silver, so you think the prices are going way higher relative to how many dollars we're printing too many of?
Yeah.
And there's no getting around it.
Not really, no. Nope. It's the oldest story in the book. And, you know, where I think it takes on new legs is when they finally, the political pressure gets too much and they don't just print and give it to big, well-connected Wall Street firms. They also have to give some to Main Street, more than the paltry amounts they've given so far. And then, so you know,
you think more helicopter money is coming?
Yeah. You know what? People will get it. And then maybe they, you know, we've heard rumblings that maybe the Fed's going to come out with a digital currency and they'll just put it into people's accounts. But who knows? Maybe they'll put a time limit on it. You have to spend it all by tomorrow or whatever the story is. Right. That's all going to happen. And meanwhile, I do think the economy picks itself up. We recover. We learn how to live with COVID. The Fed doesn't know how to do anything but put more money into the system. They just don't know how to take it back out because that makes stocks fall and then they get scared of that or something. I don't know what their internal story is, but they don't like asset prices going down. And so follow with me, Greg, out to June of next year in 2021, and we're going to find ourselves in a situation where the shale oil miracle in the United States has collapsed. Art Berman thinks to maybe 5 or 6 million barrels per day of production. We're going to be demanding. Our economy is going to be on fire at that point with all this free money that's just sort of floating around. And we're going to see inflation good and hard. The Fed's, you know, biggest hopes will be realized and then some, because we're going to actually have actual oil-based inflation come through at that point in time. That's the prediction I'm working with right now, and I think it's going to really be – people need to be ready for that. That's what our seminar is really about, becoming resilient. I think people need to be ready for much more turbulent times coming, and I think we're going to be seeing just a huge amount of – inflation's the word we'll use it, but it's really just going to be rapidly rising prices for a number of reasons.
And that's and talk about your conference, which you've already talked into. This is why wanted you to come on, because you didn't have to prepare. You're already preparing this big conference that you have going on. You do stuff all the time on YouTube. Yep. What should people, what's the theme that people, without, you know, it's 2 days of conference, so I'm sure there's a lot of themes. But what should people do now? One of the things I promoted and you coming on is that you'll identify what's going on. Lots of money printing, lots of damage to the economy. Got that. What do people need to do? What do they need to start thinking about and to prepare themselves to navigate what's coming up?
Well, we take a very consistent approach here. First is you need to understand what's happening. So we provide some great framing in this. We'll have people like Danielle DiMartino Booth talking about the Fed and what they're up to. And we have Art Berman talking about energy issues and what's really going on in the energy space. We've got some incredible people who are doing really great sustainable farming for sort of the ecological side. So well, those three E's, economy, energy, environment, get that framing and then answer the question, well, what can you do about this? There's lots that people can do. And this is about becoming resilient. And we talk this through around building up 8 different forms of capital. So if I took this camera and swiveled it to my right, what you would see is the place I live, which is now a functioning homestead here with, you know, I've got gardens, I've got animals out here, I got all that. That's my particular solution. I'm learning a lot. I'm developing a huge amount of skills, but we really believe people need to be resilient. So get your financial capital in order, develop multiple income streams as best you possibly can. Don't depend on that single paycheck, and be really smart about not keeping a lot of your dollars in a dollar-based system that's frankly rigged, and which could, you know, really, you know, I wouldn't have all my eggs in that basket. Let's put it that way.
Would you pare down as part of being resilient? And I think the answer, I know the answer to this, but I want you to say it. Is part of being resilient, because I've told people for years, you know, take some risk off the table. Debt is risk. Take some risk off the table. What's your views on indebtedness?
Well, I'm not against it. I mean, I've got some debt on some real estate going right now. But if you take on debt, it has to be for a very specific purpose where you can understand the cash flows around that, right? So, you know, I might say, you know, if one of my kids said, hey, I want to go into debt to go to college to become a surgeon, I might say, okay, that makes sense. If they said, I want to take on debt to go to college to become an art historian, I might say, that doesn't make sense, right? So that's part one. But, you know, if people have things like, it's called non-self-liquidating debt, right? You got credit card debt, you've got auto loans, student loans, stuff like that. Keep that to a minimum. This is a period of time where I think people should have as much of an operating cushion as they possibly can. That's what resilience really is. It means that you've got some sort of a buffer, and that if, God forbid, you know, you lose a job or there's some sort of other hardship that you have to attend to, then you have that reserve so that it doesn't just knock you down, take you out, right? So we're looking for people to build up their resilience in financial capital, social capital, living capital, knowledge capital and cultural capital, time, all these different forms, right? And our position is that if you have a little bit of a buffer and build those up in each of these forms of capital, then no matter what happens, you're going to fare better than you would have otherwise, or maybe than the next guy.
You sound totally sane, so it must be crazy for you to watch crazy time come to town. I mean, with the riots and the political stuff and all that. I know you don't like to talk a lot about political, but boy, the landscape on the ballot harvesting, now all of a sudden I'm seeing reports that the Dems are backing off that now. Now they're like, uh-oh, we want people to vote in person because they're afraid stuff will be disqualified. I'm probably sure they're afraid that this will end up in the Supreme Court, and they'll say, no, you can't keep an election open. November 3rd is November 3rd. You can't keep collecting votes and people keep ballot, you know, voting long afterwards. Your prediction for the political landscape, just what you think people should be looking out for without calling a winner or a loser?
No matter who wins, we're going to have half the country bitterly disappointed. I think it's obviously going to be contested pretty heavily. I would be surprised if it's a clear winner, you know, right there the day after the election. I think it's people need to be ready for quite a bit of uncertainty around all of that. You know, I certainly am expecting that. So, you know, hope for the best, but I'm planning for the worst on that. I think it's going to be fairly turbulent. We've already seen lots and lots of unhappy people all over the place, rioting, you know, all the fires and looting and stuff like that that's been going on. But in this story, Greg, I think people are going to finally wake up and realize that we're not each other. That's not who we should be fighting in this story, that we have a problem. We have a systemic problem in our country right now. It needs to be fixed. And
Comes
that
from the
systemic
top.
problem is that the elites of both parties are very busy making sure that all of the gains of the hard work and the hard workers in this country goes to a very, very few and increasingly tiny minority. That's the system the Federal Reserve is really defending. It's why I'm such a critic of what they're doing. It's not fair, and we're a social creature. We like fairness, and you can only have things be unfair for so long before the troop sort of figures that out, and then you have a different, very different problem on your hands at that point. So this election season is guaranteed to be a real nail biter, and it's guaranteed to create a lot of unhappiness. But I wish we could identify the actual source of this unhappiness. I'm not against the idea of people expressing their displeasure with a system that has said, we don't care about you, you're expendable, and we're going to just harvest your output for our own private gain. And that's an elite sort of view that honestly, it's why I say I'm not political, because I see it on both sides of the aisle in spades. If I had my way, we would have term limits and they would apply to everybody. And that would be fantastic.
I'm big on the press, and the press should be, you know, unbiased, and they should call it the way that they see it, and they should be out there. Joe Biden is now, I've been saying this, that he's, listen, I don't have to be a doctor to see that the guy, something's wrong. Something's wrong. And everybody knows it, and the press knows it. They weren't even ask him a question. And now Nancy Pelosi is out saying, well, he shouldn't debate. The debates are next Tuesday. And I'm thinking, how can he goes on a campaign stop and has to shut his campaign down the next day. He's getting questions on teleprompters and earpieces answered by people who are writing the answers out for him. I mean, this is the biggest weekend at Bernie's. I call it weekend at Biden's that you could ever see. And the press is culpable. They're also lying about the ratio of black men are being hunted down by the police. Total lie. You cannot even parse that. The press is a willing co-conspirator in the ripoff of America, are they not, in terms of their information?
Don't even get me started on the press. The Fourth Estate is failing badly. The only joy I get out of the press is when I read about their declining revenues and viewership, which is well-deserved and earned. Because what journalism used to be and should be is a pale shadow of what it was. I started doing this COVID coverage, right? And stuff I was saying back in January proved out to be really, really right.
Yeah. You know?
And along the way, all I did was follow the science and data. And for my troubles there, I got demonetized on Google. I got shadow banned. I got viewers that were unsubscribed all the time from my channel. So whatever I was saying was not what the masters at social media wanted me to say, which was basically stuff that would have been Trump harmful, I think is the key thing. And I was just talking data, and sometimes that data supported Trump and sometimes it worked against him. I don't care. I'm agnostic. I cared about the data. I live in a culture now where you can be marginalized, if not silenced, because all you're doing is reporting on the facts as you understand them and as you see them. And by the way, I change my when the facts change, I change too. That's who I am, right? So I found along the way that journalists, I think, are under that same sort of regime where they know there's a right thing you can say and a wrong thing, and the right thing leads to your career advancing and the wrong thing gets you kicked out of the press room. And so that's something I've been fighting for a long time, is helping people wake up to the idea that we don't have an operative press in the United States anymore. We have a set of interlocking corporate interests that really carefully define what you can and can't talk about. And everybody knows, you know, which side of the bread is buttered in this story. So that's why, you know, citizen journalism like yourself and myself and dozens of other people, I think, is on the rise. And of the two pieces that were written about me, this is fun, this sort of illustrates the point, that were written about me in the press because of my coronavirus coverage, both were hit pieces. One of them attacked me as somebody who was just trying to sell fear about COVID to make money without realizing that I'd already been demonetized. And what I did, putting literally over 1,000 hours into my best effort for free out into the world about COVID, it was Mother Jones that wrote that hit piece about me. And this is Mother Jones got its start as a citizens journalist outfit, right? This was started by somebody who was offended by how bad the press had gotten and had decided that citizen journalism was the way to go. I was being a citizen journalist and I got a hit piece written by, that's where we are in this story. That's how, it's just, it must be galling to you as a professional, you know, from that was your industry.
I worked at CNN and people are gonna find this shocking. It was so difficult for me to get stuff on. We had three towers. I call them three towers. It was the tower for standards. You know, do we take our cannon and shoot this fly? You know, standards. You know, do we want to do this? We can't do it. Do we want to do it? And legal. I mean, I had to fight legal. And then journalistic tower. Down in Atlanta, there was a guy down there that was just, you know, in a high position. And every one of them, I think, had to make it through those three towers. And it was difficult. I look at it now, and Jim Acosta, the crazy stuff he says. I mean, he's stupid. I mean, he wouldn't say the stupid things he says if he had to actually have scrutiny on his work. And now it's crazy. It's unbelievable. I say things that, listen, I like Donald Trump. I lean right. I'm not a Republican. And I talk about how bad the economy is. And that's not the narrative. It's, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we had 870,000 people file for first time unemployment claims. And everybody was, it's less than a million.
I know. 870,000.
We're in trouble, folks.
That's like a whole city.
That's
of people.
Yes. So anyway, listen. Your conference is. I'm going to put a link up in the after the interview section. It's in your conference. If you go to peakprosperity.com, lovely site. Lots of free stuff on your site, incidentally. The early bird discount is on September 30th. Tell me about your discount and September 30th. It ends then, and then you have it on the 24th and 25th of October, your video conference. What's the title of it, and how do you get, you know, how much does it cost?
Well, this is our Peak Prosperity Seminar. You get there by going to peakprosperity.com/seminar2020. And for all your listeners, we have our discount code of 10% off, which is USA2020. And
that's just for people watching this interview.
Yeah. Okay. That's it. That's for you guys.
USA 2020. And, okay.
And we've got so many different experts showing up, and it's going to be both recorded, so you could watch it at your leisure after the fact, or you can participate, watch it live, and be part of some live things that are happening there. There'll be panel discussions. We're going to have, as best we can, a virtual cocktail hour. You'll be able to interface with myself and a lot of other experts there, Adam Taggart and the other people we have lined up. And just a really fantastic crowd. We're really sorry we can't be doing it in person this time.
This is your annual conference.
It is our annual conference. It's been going on for a long time. And it's just a blast.
All right. So, Chris Martinson, thanks for coming on and updating us on everything front that you guys do, from the medical side, the coronavirus thing, to the damage in the economy and what you need to prepare yourself. Chris Martinson, Dr. Chris Martinson from peakprosperity.com. Let me get that out. Peakprosperity.com. All the links will be in the after the interview section for you folks on YouTube. Chris, thanks for joining us today on USAWatchdog.com.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.